Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There is a light at the end of the tunnel. If we don't blow it, we will soon find ourselves approaching something like normal life, the way it used to be, or some form of normal. Maybe it will be completely normal, but it's on us to make that happen. For over a year now, we've been talking about this pandemic, social distancing, mask wearing, testing, and thankfully, more recently, we've been talking about vaccines. In North Carolina, the supply of vaccines has now exceeded demand. That's good news, bad news. Good news because we have vaccines that almost guarantee you won't get sick. Bad news because we need near 100% participation and we have a long way to go on that, even as we run a race against variants of the virus that are more virulent and more contagious. As we move closer to normal, a lot of people want to know what normal will be like. Will we need vaccination passports? If you have your shots, will you be protected from the variants and from the fourth wave that many professionals are concerned about? And when can we stop wearing masks and feel safe around groups of strangers? So many questions. In this hour, we try to get lots of answers. Mecklenburg County Public Health Director Gibby Harris is here. Welcome back to the program. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning to you. Michael Thompson is also with us. He's an associate professor of public health sciences at UNC Charlotte and acting director of the Academy for Population Health Innovation, which is a cooperative effort, I believe, with the county. Michael, welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you.
Morning. And Hannah Smoot is with us. She's both the health and the aviation reporter for the Charlotte Observer. So she's covering two different aspects of this, and we'll talk about that as we go through the program today. Hannah, thank you for joining us again. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Gibby, let me start with you, because I'm curious about how we're doing in Mecklenburg County. Every morning, I look at my New York Times app on the phone, and for weeks now, it tells me that in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, we are at a very high risk of exposure to COVID-19, and they're reporting this morning in the 14-day change, we're down 7% in terms of hospitalizations. There have been 15 deaths in the last 2 weeks from COVID, and the positivity testing rate is 6% over the last 14 days. Would you agree with any or all of that?
To some extent, I would agree. Our numbers are fluctuating a little bit right now. You know, since we saw a major spike in January, our numbers have, I'm not going to say plummeted, but they have come down very consistently until a couple of weeks ago when we've sort of leveled out a little bit. And we see bumps up and a little bumps down in all of our metrics. So we're watching it all very closely. Over the past 7 days, our positivity rate has gone up to about 6.8%. So it's gone up just a little bit, not a lot. Our hospitalizations have gone up just a little bit. And our number of cases have gone down just a little bit over the past 7 days. So again, just a fluctuation. The problem is we're still at a point where there's lots of virus in our community. And that's the main message that we need to stay attuned to, because wearing your mask, socially distancing, avoiding large crowds, all of that is still very, very important while we're getting people vaccinated.
And you've said in the past, and I think you kind of paraphrased it a minute ago, that although the number of cases is growing slowly, we have a handle on it. Hospitalizations, I think, are up 13% or something like that in the last 2 weeks. And the hospitalizations, as I understand it, are considering a lagging indicator of where we really are. If they're going up, is that because of the recent Easter, Passover, Ramadan holidays, or is it too soon for that?
It really is too soon for us to understand the impact that the Easter weekend and spring break are going to have on the community. We'll watch that over the next week to week and a half to see if we have any significant changes based on the behavior of the holidays. We know we've seen that before with Thanksgiving, with Christmas, with New Year's. So we're hoping not to see the same thing this time.
Hannah, on over the recent holiday, the airline industry reported that air travel was at its highest level since the pandemic began. Are there concerns about that among health professionals that you've talked to and about airline employees?
I know that local health experts and Gibby included have said don't travel over spring break. You know, if you have to, follow those rules of masking and social distancing. And the air experts that I've talked to have said that they are doing everything they can to ensure that masks and social distancing are protecting people as they're traveling. Especially American Airlines, Charlotte's an American hub, has talked about how masks are required on planes. And one American pilot told me that, she will turn around the plane if people aren't doing that. So, I think that everybody in all of these industries is doing as much as they can. But local health experts have said, please avoid traveling.
Back before COVID and even in flu season, people would say, I don't want to be on a plane because you're a tin can in the sky and they're just recirculating the air. And if somebody in the front row sneezes and I'm in the back row, I'm gonna get the germs. But then when the COVID thing hit, they talked about how safe the air filtration system was in airplanes because it's bringing in lots of outside air and it's dumping it through the cabin onto the floor where it's sucked out. Do we have any definitive understanding of how well the air systems in these aircraft work, Hannah?
There have been several different studies. I don't know that we have a definitive answer, but we do know that these air filtration systems are cycling out new air. So I think maybe that's not where the danger is from COVID, because we do know that that air is getting cycled. But you're still sitting next to people.
Yeah.
That air is still, going to the person next to you before it gets cycled out. So I think that's why it's important to, try and socially distance, make sure to wear your mask.
Which brings up something else. Yes, they're still making you wear masks, but for most of the pandemic, airlines stopped booking the middle seat to try to give you a little more space than you would normally have in a full flight. But some airlines have returned to booking that seat. Are they jumping the gun?
I think that's something that people just need to be aware of. If they're planning to travel, they need to know that some airlines are still blocking off that middle seat and some aren't. And they need to, assess whether they're comfortable with it. I think if somebody is high risk for severe complications from COVID-19, they should make that decision on their own, whether they should travel or not. And if they need to travel, whether they need to book with an airline that is still blocking off that middle seat.
Michael, Charlotte Douglas International is just that. It's an international airport, a gateway to the world. Does that put our region at greater risk somehow for infections and bringing in these variants, because people are coming and going and changing planes? And even though not everybody gets on the plane in Charlotte or gets off the plane and stays here, you still got employees at the airport who then leave the airport. Does that put us in a greater risk?
It can. I think the issue is just that the sheer number of interactions we have with other people who aren't in our normal bubble creates an opportunity. For international travel, though, we have had a restriction in place that flyers need to provide a negative COVID test result before they board the plane. Mm-hmm. So that eliminates many people who are actively sick, but you still have people in that window between the time they are infectious but not testing positive. So there is still a chance that someone who is traveling into the country will be infectious during flights. There have been documented cases of people becoming infected on international flights, even where, mask wearing is documented and required. So there's a smaller chance, but a real chance. But that's very similar into the background of people moving from state to state, city to city, around the city, that, is prevalent as the COVID virus is, we're all exposed every time we're taking that risk. And so I think the more times we're interacting, and that's why the advice is to minimize non-essential travel, to minimize our excursions out, and when we are out, wear a mask and be socially distant.
What do you know about the safety of these airline air circulation systems versus taking a train, versus taking a bus or other kind of public transportation, or even going to the grocery store? Are you safer in an airplane, or are you as safe as any place else?
The physical arrangement is that the filtration system, as Hannah noted, is quite good, but you still have the bubble of air around you. Your close neighbors are at risk. And so the dose makes the poison, we like to say, in toxicology sides of things, that the longer you're exposed next to someone, the more opportunity you have. And so whether it's an airplane cabin or a train car, you know, you still have that. If you're there for 3 hours versus 5 hours on a train, you're trading time for possible proximity risk. And so it's a calculus you have to do. But the main thing is if you're wearing a cloth mask, even if you're not vaccinated, we've shown that double masking is as effective as the Pfizer vaccine, 95% effective.
Don't say that out loud. People won't get the shot.
Well, no, but do you want to wear a mask for the rest of your life? I mean, that's one option.
Okay. Gibby Harris, you talked about the positivity rate in Mecklenburg County being slightly up from what it had been. And I'm wondering if that's how confident you are in that number, given the fact that the testing, the amount of testing we are doing, has declined. So are we getting a real picture?
I don't think the picture is as real as it was when we were testing more, because we know that there are quite a few people who are infectious and asymptomatic. So the majority of people that are getting tested these days are those who know they've been exposed or who are having symptoms. So unfortunately, we may be missing some percentage of individuals in our community who are positive right now. So that number might be higher if we were testing more. The good news is we still have testing available in our community. It's free of charge. People don't need to pay for it. I know there are a lot of people that have been going places that have been paying for it, but they don't have to do that. So it's readily available. It's just that the emphasis really is on the vaccine right now. And so we are probably missing some folks that potentially need to be tested and may be positive.
How concerned are you about these new variants that are cropping up around the country? And they are here as well, particularly the B.1.1.7 variant. These variants apparently are more contagious, and they wreak greater havoc on you if you get it.
We are concerned about the variants. We're watching them all very closely. And the bad news is this is what viruses do. They mutate. Their whole purpose in their lives is to infect people and to be as virulent as they can be. So they continue to mutate, and we're starting to see more mutations throughout the world that eventually make their way to the United States, whether that's through travel or for however that happens. So the UK variant, the B.1.1.7, is proving to be more infectious, and it's also appearing to infect our younger population more than the original virus. There are other variants out there that we're keeping a close eye on. There's one in India that seems to be a particular concern right now. And all of these seem to be a bit more challenging when it comes to the types of infections that people are experiencing and how severe those are. So we're keeping a really close eye on those. Up to this point, we are seeing that the vaccines that we have provide some protection with these variants. So it's important, again, to get vaccinated. But again, something that we're just going to have to keep a very close eye on.
Yeah, these variants, particularly the B.1.1.7, evidently, as you said, is infecting younger people and children. And children, young children, cannot get vaccines. When we come back, I want to talk about that and why this is happening, why this particular variant seems to impact young people. And then we'll talk about the vaccines and vaccinations and what to expect after you get one. What happens to you then? What can you do? Can you run hog wild to the streets? We'll talk about that with Gibby Harris, Michael Thompson, and Hannah Smoot as Charlotte Talks continues on 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Hannah Smoot. She's a reporter for health and aviation at the Charlotte Observer. Gibby Harris is the public health director for Mecklenburg County. And Michael Thompson is also with us, associate chair of public health sciences at UNC Charlotte. And Michael, these these variants that have made their presence known in this country, particularly here, particularly the B117 virus, the variant from UK, as Gibby Harris just pointed out, seems to impact younger people more than the previous versions of this virus. Do we understand why?
Not necessarily, and it may just be an artifact that the younger population are the largest reservoir of unvaccinated people right now, that the virus in those variants is more infectious, it's more pernicious. We have all these competing factors. We have schools going back into session more. We have spring break travel, increasing the risk of transmission. Given the shift in emphasis for testing, we're more likely to be seeing it in kids where before they're more asymptomatic. So if this is a bit more serious, kids who might have had it and gone undetected are now being picked up through our increased surveillance. So it's not necessarily clear that they're more susceptible. We're just better at detecting the cases that we have among children. And that's the largest concentrations of interactions we're having among people who are unvaccinated. And it's much harder to force the social distancing requirements, the mask and so forth. Kids are much harder to do, as we've seen, even some of our young adults. It's very hard to get them to comply with behaviors we know are protective.
Yeah, and of course, that's what gets the attention on television and even to a certain extent on radio and in newspapers, Hannah. You're young, so I'm going to ask you for some anecdotal conversation here, because we do see pictures of spring breakers crowding in the streets and people celebrating victories in athletic events, crowding onto the field or the court after a game, and they're not masked, and they're all 20 years old. Is that just an aberration, or as you associate with your colleagues and friends who are your age, are they aware that the B117 variant seems to be hitting them more than others?
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. I think that all of my friends and colleagues were very aware of this, and we're taking it very seriously. But I think, you know, we've seen a lot in a lot of other places, as colleges reopened, as schools reopened, that people weren't necessarily following those social distancing guidelines. I don't know if that's just a factor of being young and getting to see your friends again. But I think that is something that young people need to take especially seriously. And we know that Pfizer has pushed for younger and younger people to get this shot with their study between 12 and 15. Pfizer is currently the only shot that's authorized for people 16 years old and 17 years old. I think that in the coming weeks, hopefully we'll start to see those shots opened up to younger people, and hopefully that will help.
And there have been reports, Gibby, around the country of young children. I mean, we're talking about first grade, second grade, third graders getting the COVID virus. I don't know whether it's one of the variants or the original virus. Have there been any outbreaks in Mecklenburg County or in the surrounding counties among young children who cannot get this vaccine yet?
The outbreaks that we've seen have been more in the 12 to 17 year old age group, although we have had some outbreaks in our child care centers in the county over the past months, as well as a few in our elementary schools. But I will have to tell you that the majority of the outbreaks have been in 12 to 17 year olds and have been more focused on sports teams than they have been on kids in classes. So that has been a group that I've been concerned about for some time because of the exposure that they have and the fact that 12 to 17 year olds are probably out in the community more than our younger age group and have the potential of spreading the virus as well. So we're watching that very closely. We work very closely with our school systems, both private and public, to make sure we're tracking all of this and recognizing those outbreaks as soon as they happen and quarantining the folks that we need to. But until we can get those children vaccinated, we're going to see outbreaks in those settings.
Yeah, Gibby just talked, Michael, about daycare centers being a concern, and that is one of the concerns. And according to the CDC director, Rochelle Walensky, kids in youth sports are also a concern, particularly they seem to be most impacted by the uptick in cases of the B117 variant. Here and around the country, kids are returning to school, and when they return to school, they are engaging in extracurricular activities and indoor sports. Have we allowed this to happen too soon, Michael?
It's a tough balancing act. I think people's assessment of their risk is often quite different from what we could say objectively it might be. And particularly for adolescents, that sense of risk and risk-taking is quite different threshold than we as older adults might do. So it is a challenge, and it's that balance of the immediacy of being able to engage in these activities versus considering the long-term consequences, particularly now that some data is also emerging that people who have suffered from COVID have an increased risk of potentially neurological and mental health diagnoses later on, that it's not just the immediate fact that it's a mild illness for most children, but what might the longer term consequences be as they become adults?
Michael Osterholm, who's the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, says new evidence about the B.1.1.7 variant and kids made him rethink his stance on reopening schools for in-person learning. He says it's a totally different virus in the sense of what it's doing epidemiologically. I think, he says, school openings today are going to greatly enhance the transmission of the B.1.1.7 variant in our communities, and I predict that within weeks we will be revisiting this issue, unfortunately, after we've had substantial transmission. Gibby Harris, what's your take on that?
That, you know, it is of concern. What I will say is at this point we are not seeing extensive spread of variants in our community based on the surveillance and the sequencing that's being done in the state at this point. But I do think it's something we need to pay close attention to, and it'll be interesting as folks start coming back from spring break, because we know that not just college students went on spring break, families went on spring break. Children went on spring break. You look at the airports and you see little kids in the airports. So you know that those folks were out and about as well. So even if we're not seeing a lot of the variant in our community at this point, with folks going out and coming back, that could change. So I do think the next couple of weeks are going to tell us a lot in terms of the impact of spring break and the potential that we may see more spread of some of these variants in our community, and then what kind of impact does that have on which parts of our population? We're just going to have to watch.
We've talked about this in the past, and I'm curious if you've changed your mind about it, about the kind of pressure, Gibby, that you have been under, because you have to balance social health, public health issues against public pressure. Both political and otherwise, and there was this big push to get kids back to school because of the obvious problems of not having them in school. That's completely true. But if you were the czar, if all these health professionals in America could have made the final decision and their word was law, would we, A, be back in school and be reopening right now, or would we have already been back in school and reopened because we locked down tighter for the time it took to get rid of this disease?
That's a difficult question. I think that the challenge that we have in our communities is the prioritization of what we need to have open, right? We, in some cases, prioritized opening bars and restaurants over getting schools opened. And from my perspective, opening the schools was the most important. Our children needed to be back in school. We know the impact that not having the social interaction and the ability to learn in different ways is critical to our kids as they move forward. So, you know, from my perspective, having the schools open is probably a really good thing, but we don't always prioritize. We need to make sure that we are doing all the things in our community that are going to prevent the spread so that our schools can stay open. And that might mean not having bars as open as people would like them to be, and not having restaurants as open as people would want them to be, and not having street festivals and all the other things that we want to happen. So again, it's a matter of priority from my perspective.
Hannah, we are said to be in a race against these variants to get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible, so these variants have less of a chance to spread and infect people and give them even worse situations and the higher death rate, etc. Given as of, and I think these numbers are relatively accurate, the vaccine supply in North Carolina outstrips demand, but as of last week, 31.5% of all North Carolinians have been at least partially vaccinated, and 22.2% are fully vaccinated, with Mecklenburg County at about 19% of those over 18 and 59% of, that's a lot of numbers, 59% of people 65 and older. As you talk to health people around the state and around the country, are we set up to win this race? Are we going to win this race if this keeps up?
You know, I don't know if anyone knows right now if we're going to win, but I think that there is, you know, a lot of urgency surrounding these vaccines. And that is why it's so important to get these vaccines out to local communities, to get these vaccines to local providers, and to make sure that people are getting them. You know, I know the governor was in Gastonia last week, I believe, and, you know, said that they are focusing on getting more vaccines to local providers, because that's who people in the community trust. They trust their, you know, family doctor they've been going to for years. And that's what's going to help people overcome vaccine hesitancy.
Even the Trump administration, which handled this miserably, even they were pointing to the importance of finding and developing and releasing vaccines. Those vaccines have now come to the market in record time. And President Trump, former President Trump over the weekend, said you ought to call it Trumpscene, because he was responsible for these vaccines. But there are groups of people who would also put themselves in many cases in the Trump camp who are hesitant to get the vaccine. Among them, evangelical Christians appear to be hesitant to get this, and they're going to spend the whole next hour on this on 1A. African Americans fall into that category. Some are hesitant. Some have difficulty getting the vaccine because of how the whole thing is set up to register and get in line for it. And some healthcare workers, Michael, are hesitant to get the vaccine. Hospitals who are willing to disclose employee vaccination records report that between 40 and 75% of hospital staff members are vaccinated. I would have thought that number would be closer to 100%. These people are healthcare workers. So that seems low. Is it?
It is, and it's somewhat surprising, but I think, as you've mentioned, there are several groups and people have a variety of reasons, from sort of more political ideological reservations to people who have legitimate reasons to have distrust of the healthcare system, given the history. And so, you know, the messaging so far has been focused on sort of making sure that the people who were able, managing demand, so that only the people who were eligible were seeking vaccines, trying to have everyone wait in line. Now the tipping point is switching, so now that supply is going to be more plentiful than demand, and we have to now begin focusing our message on how to encourage people who may be hesitant or reluctant to step forward and take a vaccine.
But if you don't have
the challenge is that people, you need to understand where people's reservations are, not just what they're saying their reservations are, because I was looking at some of this, and some of the same people who are hesitant to the vaccine seem to be the same people who are talking about support for voter ID laws, and it's like, there's something fundamentally different there. That's not what the objective is, not really what they're saying. And we need to find out what that is to help better frame our messaging.
And if you don't have near 100% participation in getting vaccinated among healthcare workers, Michael, what message is that sending to those who are legitimate, have legitimate concerns about this vaccine?
It is a problem, because if the sense that you're conveying to the community is that not even the healthcare workers believe in the vaccine, that's not the message you want out there. Maybe it's because these workers were already sick with COVID and think they don't need it. They're waiting for others. Are there other legitimate reasons? But it's unlike wearing masks, where it's very clear if someone's wearing a mask or not. We don't have a little star on our face or something that's telling people that we've been vaccinated or not, and it's a trust system. So we are trusting that the healthcare workers are providing. We're going to be trusting that the members of our community are vaccinated. That's the only way we'll be able to return to a post-pandemic
Gibby
world
Harris,
to reestablish trust.
Gibby, the Raleigh News and Observer reports that about a fifth of North Carolina adults do not plan to get the vaccine. That's 20%. That is a high number. Why shouldn't getting a vaccine be mandatory?
Well, you know, that has been a question. Why don't healthcare systems require it of their employees? I mean, our department requires flu vaccine of our employees every fall. But we have not required this vaccine at this point. You can't require something if it's not readily available, right? We could not in the early stages even consider requiring the vaccine. So I think that we might see some of that changing as we move through. And one point I will make about healthcare workers is when they give that number, they include everyone that works in those hospital systems. So that includes the custodians, the folks that handle the HVAC systems, that includes the folks that run the cafeterias. So it's not just those folks who are nurses, doctors, you know, those sorts of folks that are included in that percentage. And that, I think, impacts how many actually have gotten the vaccine. But I think as we move forward, there will likely be some places that require you to have a vaccine before you enter.
Yeah.
It could be an airline. It could be a restaurant. It could be any type of places. They have the opportunity to do that at some point. And as we move forward, it's possible that we will see some of that. I'm just not sure exactly how quickly that will move.
They have that opportunity in some states, not in Florida and not in Texas, which we'll talk about that in a second. But Michael, there have been adverse reactions to some of these shots. Just last week, we had reactions among people in North Carolina at certain locations to the Johnson & Johnson shot, which is the one-shot vaccine, and they momentarily stopped giving out that vaccine for a day or two. What do we know about those reactions? I mean, how concerned should we be? And are those reactions any different from the reactions that people sometimes get to the flu shot?
Yeah, I think, and it's hard when you hear about clusters of 7 to 10 events in a mass vaccination kind of situation, but there's a mix of things going on. Particularly for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, it attracts a lot of people who already have a concern about being immunized or having shots, and you have this heightened emotional situation. So if you're around seeing someone have a bad reaction, that can kind of precipitate a lot of other bad reactions just through sort of shared sympathy.
So are you saying that those reactions last week in places in North Carolina and around the country could have been psychosomatic?
Some of them could have been, but some of them just, when you're talking about rare events, doesn't mean they can't happen consecutively. So just because 7 happened very close together, doesn't mean that it's a sign. But they did pause to look at that.
Michael Thompson is the Associate Chair of Public Health Sciences at UNC Charlotte. We're coming right back with Gibby Harris and Hannah Smoot in just a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Gibby Harris is with us, Public Health Director of Mecklenburg County. Michael Thompson, Associate Chair of Public Health Sciences at UNC Charlotte, and Hannah Smoot, reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Gibby, at first it wasn't easy to get a shot, but now vaccine supply has outstripped demand. Has it gotten any easier? Because the hoops you had to go through to get in line for the shot were unbelievably stupid.
Yeah, it has gotten easier, and we're continuing to look in Mecklenburg County with our vaccinating partners at how we can continue to make it easier, especially as we have more vaccine available. You know, we still have some of the constraints that we had early on because Pfizer is still sort of a fragile vaccine. And once you take it out of the refrigerator, and then once you reconstitute that vial that's got 6 doses in it, you've got 6 hours to give it. And if you don't get it done in 6 hours, you have to toss it. So it we still have some of those challenges, but we are looking at opportunities to provide vaccine in the community where it can be walk up. People can, you know, they see a vaccine site, they can stop and get a vaccine. We're also seeing in some of our clinics, both the healthcare system as well as the health department, no shows because people made multiple appointments and they'll go where they can get it first. So we have lists of people that we can call. And so far we've had good success getting people in for these vaccines. But I think as more vaccine is available, we will see more and more additional vaccine in our community that's not necessarily being used right away.
Some Walgreens.
We've been getting it out every week. I don't think we're going to see that as we move forward.
Some Walgreens pharmacies have the vaccine and are giving it out, as do some Harris Teeter pharmacies. I believe Publix pharmacies began today in North Carolina. The Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine both need to be stored at ridiculously low temperatures. And we were told that that would prohibit them from being given out at pharmacies because they don't have the equipment to keep it at that temperature. Michael, how is that being accomplished? How are pharmacies able to do this all of a sudden?
Some of it is just the logistics and planning, where they will have a central delivery system, where they may have a central location. They know the supply coming in will reconstitute it and send it out to the pharmacies for very quick administration. Others, some of the larger pharmacies are actually getting freezer capacity to be able to do this, or at least sometimes they've developed those systems. Walgreens, for example, got chastised by the CDC recently for scheduling its Pfizer appointments four weeks apart to be consistent with Moderna, even though it was 21 days. So now they bring in their appointment system in line. So if they're scheduling you for the Pfizer, it's still 21 days, not the 21-8 days. That was more of a scheduling issue, not a storage issue.
But they don't have these freezers that keep these vaccines at super low temperatures like some hospitals have. Gibby Harris, does it concern you that there's going to be spoilage, that people will get the shots, but the shots won't be any good?
Right now, we're not concerned about that, and I'll tell you why. We have been working with pharmacies, with grocery stores, with doctor's offices, with others in the community to build their capacity to manage this vaccine. And what is happening right now is we are receiving additional vaccine every week in the health department. Pfizer comes in a tray of 975 doses. None of these, and you have a week to keep it in a refrigerator and be able to get it out. None of these places can do 975 doses a week. So what we are doing is accepting the trays and then transferring small amounts to the grocery stores, to the pharmacies, to the doctor's offices that they can handle in a week because we have the freezer capacity. So we've been working on that process for a month and a half now, and it's working fairly well. So we can push the vaccine out in the amounts that they can handle in the time frame that's appropriate so the vaccine does not spoil.
When you get the vaccine, you are given a card, and you hang on to that card because the card tells you when you got it, what kind of vaccine you received, and then when you get the second dose, if there is a second dose, and there is for Moderna and Pfizer, you get another sticker that tells you when you got the second shot and what shot you got. These have become, they were told to hang on to the card and not laminate the card because we don't know yet, but we may need booster shots, and they would want to add that information to the card, so don't laminate it. But we're supposed to hang on to it. To me, that becomes, Hannah, a de facto COVID passport. And there has been much discussion about the development of a COVID passport that you would then use to get into airlines, into cruise ships, into amusement parks, even restaurants, as Gibby Harris mentioned a moment ago. In your conversations with people, are they worried? Are they concerned about this? Because as somebody just said, the same people who are concerned about voter ID, we got to have voter ID, don't want these passports.
Yeah, you know, I think that it's a fair argument that everyone needs to have access to these records. And you know, you need to have access to your own vaccination records. So I don't see a problem with giving people access. And I know that, you know, the governor has said that they're working on a way to make sure that people have voluntary access to their vaccination records, whether that's to show to businesses that may require it in the form of some sort of app or something. You know, and I haven't heard from many people who are worried about that. I think because there's not a lot of privacy issues necessarily if you're the one volunteering that information, if the information is given to you.
One of the things that we have learned from this, Gibby Harris, is that public health officials and medical experts had their finger on what would get us out of this pretty quickly, and there was resistance for many different reasons, some legitimate, some not so. But shouldn't public health trump privacy at the very least? If you've gotten the vaccine and you have a card, why shouldn't you be mandated to show it to participate in certain things? Why shouldn't public health trump privacy?
that is a constant balancing act for public health, is balancing the needs of the community versus the individual rights that people have. We constantly balance that. I anticipate that there will probably be some venues that will require it, and they will do that on their own.
But you know, individual rights, it's not just your right to not show me your passport or your give me an indication of your vaccination status. It's my right to know that the person sitting next to me at the movies is safe.
That is a bigger issue than a local health director can tackle.
Okay.
It's really sort of a national agenda item, I think, and probably going to have a lot of discussion over the next month or so. I'm not even sure whether governors are going to tackle that at the state level.
Well, some governors have. The Republican governors of Florida and Texas have already banned the use of passports. In Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis has banned both government and businesses from requiring them. Can he do that, Michael? Can he do that? I mean, can he ban a business, Disney World, for instance, and say you can't ask for passports?
Well, I'm not sure about his statutory authority, but I think, you know, the principle for policies from a public policy perspective is you want to have a policy that's as tailored as appropriate. So if you're doing something at restricting people's mobility, you would like to do that as in a focused way as possible. So rather than blanketly banning everybody, it would be nice to only have to limit those who haven't yet been vaccinated in certain venues, because we know the densities. But the problem right now is we have the concerns about equity, access, and so forth, about the equality that, you know, our marginalized communities may not have access to the vaccine. Depending on how these vaccine passport systems are set up, they may not have access to that. So there's a concern about discrimination and access in that way. And so that's the tension that Gibby was talking about. What's the boundary between what we're willing to accept? We accept certain things as seasonal flus, cold things, is some, you know, the risk, the common risk that we all share. This is a novel virus, and we don't have the protection of having had childhood immunizations where the kids have gone through school and everyone has basically got shared immunity. We're very different right now. And so we have a group of haves and have-nots, and we want to not reopen until we have equity and that access.
Hannah, there was a story in The Observer last week announcing that some North Carolina high school students could be asked to pass a COVID-19 test before being allowed to go to their proms or to graduation ceremonies this spring. Those decisions, for now, will be made at the local level. Have you heard of any plan to require tests or proof of vaccination of those participating or attending graduation ceremonies or proms in Mecklenburg County or the surrounding counties?
You know, I have not yet. I think that is something that could happen, but I have not heard plans for that.
There is some question about whether airlines and cruise ships may begin requiring proof of vaccination, and the same may be true of theaters when they completely reopen. You cover aviation. What have you heard about that from the airlines?
I mean, for many travelers, a proof of COVID test is already required, depending on where you're going. For different U.S. states, you know, in some places, you must show that you have had a COVID test. So I don't think that that's unlikely. I think that probably will continue to be at the state level, at the destination level. But, you know, we're already seeing that happening in some cases.
President Biden's administration has said, and I think it was his press secretary who said this last week, the government is not now, nor will we be, supporting a system that requires Americans to carry a COVID credential. There will be no federal vaccinations database and no federal mandate requiring everyone to obtain a single vaccination credential. Gibby, is that smart?
That's a hard question, I think. The approach that we've taken in this country about vaccines in terms of requirements has been more around populations and requiring vaccines for certain settings. And it's possible that we would go that route. I mean, in North Carolina, obviously, we require certain vaccines for children to go to school in the fall and to stay in school. And at some point, we may do that. I think that But I think the issue of requiring people to carry a card around with them and prove that they've been vaccinated is not likely anytime soon. And I need to stay focused more on getting as many people vaccinated as possible. The whole equity issue that Michael mentioned, and the fact that everybody needs to have access and needs to be encouraged to be vaccinated, and that we need to do what we can to help people understand why that's so important and get their questions answered.
Hannah, you've reported on this, so let's make this very clear to everybody listening. When you get your vaccinations, when you are fully vaccinated, what exactly can you do? Who exactly can you be around, and under what circumstances?
So the CDC has released new guidelines on that. And to be clear, when you're considered fully vaccinated is 2 weeks after your last dose, whether that's the second dose of Pfizer or Moderna, or 2 weeks after the first dose of Johnson & Johnson. The CDC has said that people who are fully vaccinated can begin to gather inside with other people who are fully vaccinated. You should still be wearing your mask. You should still be social distancing, especially in public and in crowds.
And these vaccines are not 100% effective. So if you get your vaccine, Gibby Harris, what's the likelihood that if you are exposed, you will come down with symptoms? Or if you are exposed, you will be carrying the virus around asymptomatically, not knowing that you have it and having an ability to spread it to somebody else?
So as you mentioned, these are not 100%. And we're continuing to learn more about the effectiveness of these vaccines the longer they're out there. Obviously, right now we're seeing that for the most part, these vaccines are at least as good for 6 months. That number could be extended as we have more time to study the vaccines. And the other thing we know is that these vaccines are incredibly effective. Compared to a flu vaccine, these vaccines have it all over flu vaccines. They're much more effective than flu vaccines. And some to the point of being 90% effective in preventing both getting the virus and spreading the virus. But all of them are very effective in keeping people from becoming ill, needing hospitalization, and potential death. So we know that we've got an effective vaccine here, and that's why people need to move forward and get their vaccine, especially now that it's more readily available.
These vaccines use a whole different technology from anything that came before them. Will these change, Michael, the way flu vaccines, for instance, or other vaccines are manufactured and the way they are constructed?
It could potentially. It's the first time we've seen these mRNA vaccines, the Pfizer and the Moderna, and it does seem to allow for more rapid customization and of vaccine. So it may be open to new technology. I think the problem with the flu is that it mutates so rapidly that it's often hard to figure out what's the best strategy. But going back to Gibby's comments about effectiveness, I think it's probably important to clarify that when we say something is 90% effective, we said the vaccine was 95% efficacious. That's under ideal conditions. 90% is what we're seeing in the field, which is extraordinarily good. But it doesn't mean that 90 out of 100 people won't get get sick. What it means is that given the rate of infection we've seen in the community when it's unimmunized, we would reduce it by 90% if we immunized everybody. So if we were seeing 1,000 cases, we'll go down to only 100 cases if we immunize everybody. That's a much broader impact than what 90% is conveying to people. It's tremendous.
Gibby, you've said that we need people to make the effort to get the vaccine. It's worth it. It's worth it to you. It's worth it to individuals around you, those you love, those you care about, and those you work with. I hope that message is getting out and resonating. But in 10 seconds or less, when can we stop wearing the masks? When can we stop social distancing?
So we may see some improvement in that over the summer, but this is a virus that could very well come back up in the fall and the spring. I mean, the fall and the winter. So masks are here to stay for a while.
Okay. Gibby Harris, Public Health Director, Mecklenburg County. Michael Thompson, Associate Chair, Public Health Sciences at UNC Charlotte. And Hannah Smoot with the Charlotte Observer. Thanks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.